many people at one of our events, and two wonderful writers, our dear colleague Greg Donovan and Aaron McGraw, whom I would love to consider dear and a colleague in that great sense of a literary community. And I am here to introduce Aaron's work. And this is the book that the graduate workshop read as we were working on short stories. And it's called The Good Life. And it's hard not to pick up a book that promises something like the good life or better food for a better world. So even if your soul is steeped in the darkest melancholy, you kind of have to twist the knife to find out what a better world might look like. And Aaron's stories show people at the worst moments of their lives trying to be good, or at least to find some kind of compromise that will bring about a partial happiness. And that's the best world we can hope for. Her work is very hooky, as we called it in workshop, and insistent. It's not going to let go of you. When I was reading The Good Life, I found myself staying up way past a healthy bedtime because I'd reach the satisfying conclusion to one story and then I'd take a peek at, you know, what's going to happen in the next story, and it hooked me and I had to keep reading until I got to the end of that character's arc. So it's easy to see why those stories and Aaron's essays, too, have found a wide range of readers, from slick magazines to erudite literary journals. She's been everywhere, in The Atlantic, Story, Allure, Good Housekeeping, The Kenyon Review, The Georgia Review, and more places than I can count. In the novel The Seamstress of Hollywood Boulevard, which is very dear to my heart, actually, a young mother, A young mother decides to leave her family in Kansas. I have no children, okay? And travel to Los Angeles, where her skill with the needle gets her into the movie business, and her reputation later leads her grown-up daughters back to her. So readers might not always approve of the decisions Aaron's characters make, but there is a generosity of spirit in the author's way of looking at even the most selfish decision that brings a kind of comfort and a sense that we might be living good lives after all. I read The Seamstress of Hollywood Boulevard in one or two sittings and keep thinking about that young mother growing into middle age and just waiting for her past to catch up with her. Aaron's past has caught up with her tonight. Where's Clint? Clint McCown went to graduate school with Aaron, and so they're having a reunion, but from across a very crowded room right now. And I'm so glad that Clint introduced me to Aaron at a long ago AWP in Atlanta, and even gladder that I've had a chance to read and discuss her extraordinary work, which includes six books, including The Lies of the Saints and Bodies at Sea. She's been a Stegner Fellow at Stanford, and she's had other fellowships at Yaddo and McDowell. She teaches at The Ohio State University, and Samuel R. Delaney praised her in his book on writing as one of the best of her generation. Her new book, Better Food for a Better World, is a love note to Davis, California, which is coincidentally the town where I was born. A marijuana-tinged town where she writes, this is from her website, she went into a storm of ecstasy the first time she saw the plum trees all over town break into flower. It promises the Grateful Dead, and as she notes on her website, also there's a juggler and a fat contortionist. Finally. So I asked the short fiction workshop to contribute some comments about The Good Life, and I'm going to end with those. Samantha Drake wrote that it's easy to write a story about things falling apart, but Aaron McGraw succeeds in the impossible task of writing the flawed pieces back together. Her stories are believable in a way I'm not used to seeing, and I can't figure out why. We spent a good while discussing why, and Aaron will try and let us into some of the mysteries later, maybe. Cade Varnado wrote that it is impressive to see a writer showing that normal problems can be as challenging as gloom and doom. He is a self-professed doom and gloom writer. And Jake Brannigan says that the way McGraw examines the flaws in the people in our lives we hope are flawless, parents, lovers, priests, makes for characters both complex and troubled in unimaginable ways and as real as anyone we know from the neighborhood. So here to make a better world believable is Aaron McGraw.
Extraordinarily generous. And this is a good crowd. This is amazing. Thank you all for coming out. You back in McCown? All right, okay. About a year ago, I finished a new book and found myself, the way I usually do after I finish a new book, uncertain about what to do next and what to do with my time and what to do with my hands and just what to do. And so I was splashing around a bit and a few different editors for different publications asked me to write very, very short pieces for projects they had going on. This is not something I normally do, and in fact, it's not a form I normally like very much, the really, really short prose form. But I got going with these, and they've started to take on a life of their own. And, so I've got, at this point, quite a stack of these 2 to 5 page stories, and my challenge to myself is to see how short I can go and still tell a story. And so that you can judge for yourselves how successful I have been. The loose umbrella title I'm using for all of these pieces is American Lives, which doesn't commit me to much. I like that. This very first one doesn't have a title yet, but it's an Indiana story, Glenn. Wayne is a good man. I'm lucky to get him. People keep telling me those things as if I need reminding. He took care of his troubled sister from the time he was 19 years old, tracking her more than once to the houses where she was shooting up and taking her back home again. Wayne's youth was sacrificed on the altar of that girl. I should be grateful that a man like that wants to marry me now, when the skin under my eyes is showing lines and the legs that used to look slim and good in shorts now just look like stalks. I am grateful. But shouldn't a man have wanted a little more out of his life? Shouldn't a man have taken some time off from his mess of a sister once in a while, going out to the quarry with a few guns and friends who'd been drinking? He took care of her to the day she died and after. He was the one to wash her body for the funeral. People talked. This is exactly why I need to wear a white dress, even if white makes me look little and washed out. Mama said I could pass for a used cotton ball. She thinks I should have a pink wedding gown. She thinks I look good in pink, which is true, but she forgets that white means something. I'm not talking about how I've had other boyfriends. Everybody in town knows that. White means respect for the tradition, and I'm trying to get this right. I have thoughts that are not helpful. What does it mean that a man who spent 10 years chasing down his sister in shooting galleries thinks that marrying me is the natural next move? Mama tells me not to say such things. I don't see why I shouldn't. Everybody who saw me pulling into park at Monica's bridal did. I tried on a dress that Wayne would like, strapless, with lots of flounces on the skirt. The sales girl had to pin it to hold it up, chattering, "Aren't you tiny? Not many of the girls who come in are so little." I looked in the mirror and saw a broomstick rising from a mound of whipped cream. "Maybe something with sleeves," I said to her, while Mama said, "You can always dye it pink." She was trying to make this a happy day. One look at her face told me she was remembering my first day of school, my first bike, the days before every room started to seem too small. Once she sent me to school in a turtleneck, and by the time I got home, I'd cut out the neck with craft scissors. I'm too old now to wear a dress designed for a 20-year-old, and Wayne must know that. He's not a fool, and he doesn't close his eyes when he looks at me. He says, "I like a girl that's been around the block." Well, he shouldn't. He should stand up straighter and get mad enough to snarl at the girl he's going to marry when she comes home later than she said she would and drunk besides. When she lets the guy she works with tease her that the fellow she's marrying is fussy as an old lady, Wayne shrugs and says, "People say things," and then he asks what I want for dinner. Sometimes the words are right there in my mouth. Oh, grow up hair. He fusses at me, tucking in my scarf and putting chapstick on my lips so I don't have to dig through my purse for gloss. His eyes are calm when he does these things. He loves to tuck in my scarf. I was barely 14 when I went joyriding with Neil Osterman. He was 19, and I knew where we were going and what we were going to do there, and I yelled faster whenever he slowed down. By the time we got to the quarry, he was leaving rubber at every corner, including the one where we'd spun out and got a grill full of green corn. Drunk, of course, both of us, and loud, hollering as we swung on the rope over glassy water. People think that Neil's drunk hand slipped on the rope and he fell onto the boy swimming below us, but it wasn't so simple. Neil was bombing for him, and I was hanging on to Neil, screaming either go, go, or no, no. The versions vary. I'd been drinking, too. Was that my sin, or was it the two of us, slick and wet teenage bodies, landing on that little boy, or was it me holding my head up after the funeral that every soul in town seemed to turn up for? My other sin was continuing to ride with Neil till he got locked up. Wayne knows all of this, I made sure. I don't want him coming home from the Napa shop one day with his mouth folded back against the words he doesn't want to say to me. He wants to protect me, even now. Do you still love Neil? Is that it? Mama had demanded after she heard that I'd turned Wayne down a second time. Of course I don't love Neil. It was Neil's house that Wayne hauled his sister out of. Without even trying, I can conjure Neil's lazy sneer. He liked to blow cigarette smoke in my mouth when we kissed. No woman in her right mind loves Neil. The sales call brought me another dress. You know him, don't you? The sales girl brought me another dress with lacy sleeves that ate at my arms like a tracing of fire ants. The lace rode up in a high collar. You won't be able to fasten this yourself, but your mama can help you, the sales girl said. Mama looked unhappy. What did she think we were buying, a party dress? The lace pinched, so stiff I could barely bend my elbows. Look at you, bride, the sales girl said. In the mirror stood a girl, skinny as a needle, her skin gray underneath the stupid white lace. You'll be wrapped up too tight to dance at your own wedding, Mama said. The sales girl started to talk about alterations, and Mama was saying, Hank, both of them chattering until I said, hush, as if I had a right. Are you crying, Mama said? That's tears of joy, the sales girl said. I see that a lot. You keep thinking that, I said. My arms were too stiff at my sides to wipe my eyes, so a drop landed on the dress, spotting it and making it mine now. So that's One American Life. I have a few thank yous before I go on. I want to thank Tom, who took good care of me and got me here and took care of all of the details, and all of the people who were responsible for extending this invitation. I'm just so grateful for that. And one of the people there in that lineup who's important to me and I know important to you is Claudia Emerson. And, Claudia was a real good friend. And being here in this place made her very, very happy. This one does have a title. It's called Haircut. 2 days ago, my daughter cut her hair off. She is 4. She used a cowlick that now curls like plumage from the crown of her head. Adorable. Everything the child touches turns to gold. It seems impossible that she could be the sum of Larry and me. His crabs, my clap. His bad breath, my teeth. Our habit, which brought us together long enough to make Stella and then wonderfully drove us apart. Stella doesn't know about him. Sometimes when Larry comes through town, he and I see each other for old time's sake. When Stella is safe with my sister. My girl is not like me. She reads already and dances. I told Larry about Stella's pealing laughter when she, age 1, encountered a soap bubble, and he said, cheap bait. I haven't told him anything about her since. He thinks I'm raising Stella wrong, and he isn't the only one. Janice, my friend at work, asked me just what I'm waiting for. Kids her age go to preschool. They have play dates. You don't have to keep her in Fort Knox. I give her tests. She's scoring off the top of every one of them, I said. What's going to happen when she starts school and finds out she's not the center of the universe? I haven't told Janice yet about the homeschooling. I'll need to get my GED, which I started years ago and put aside when I didn't see the point. Now I hit the books after Stella goes to bed, pulling out sample tests on math and social studies that I hide in a high cabinet during the day. No point in raising questions if Larry comes over. But I've got to be nimble. Stella will catch up with me before I know it. She stampedes into daycare, racing to see her friends and kiss the stuffed moose that is her favorite. She was three when Laura, who runs the place, pulled me aside and said, "I think she's reading." Her long face looked worried, as if I was going to be mad that she let my brilliant little girl read when I wasn't looking. "I didn't teach her," she said. "I know," I assured her. Laura doesn't run the kind of daycare where three-year-olds learn to read, but the kids are clean, and she teaches them to shave. Stella can write her name and mine, and she draws the puppy she wants me to get for her. She resets the oven clock when we switch from daylight savings time, and she knows what daylight savings time is. She knows the names of our mailman and our neighbors, and though she doesn't run up to them, I'm careful about what I let her do. She waves and says hello. She charmed Adele Burgess one snowy day when Adele came stumping up the street behind her walker, scowling at the slushy pavement. "The snowflakes are dancing," Stella said, not her usual kind of talk. I thought maybe she was afraid of Adele, and so she let herself sound babyish. Adele was afflicted with everything. Bad feet and swollen knees and skin that caught and tore like paper, and she met everyone she saw with a long list of joints that pained her. But on this day, she smiled at Stella. "I didn't know the old bitch could." "You have quite an imagination," Adele said. After she was out of earshot, Stella leaned toward me. "The snowflakes are really just falling, but I thought she might like to hear about dancing." GED sample question. What is an opinion rather than a fact? "It's time for you to meet someone," Janice tells me. "I've got a kid at home. Guys would rather start fresh. You have a pretty smile and long hair. Plenty of guys would give you a chance." Did I say I was interested? "That girl of yours is going to want a daddy, or a brother or sister. Maybe you could get a car with air conditioning out of the deal." "Got my whole life worked out, don't you?" I smile. She smiles back. I have a better life than hers, so she's allowed to be bossy. It was Janice, of all people, who made me quit smoking before Stella was born. I've seen that woman go through 3 packs in a night, but she kept taking cigarettes out of my fingers when we were on breaks. "You don't want a dumb one," she said. Her kids are with their dad's mother. Now she reaches out to touch my hair. "You can borrow my flat iron." For a treacherous second, I remember how it used to be, with music and beer bottles and hot hands against my waist. Stella is used to hearing about Janice the same way I'm used to hearing about Lewis at her daycare center, who won't drink chocolate milk unless graham crackers are crumbled into it. I don't expect her to think much when I tell her that Janice and I might go out some night, and Stella would be able to stay with her aunt and watch whatever TV my sister thinks is right for a girl age 4 going on 19. "Is it a date?" Stella asks. "Silly. Janice is my friend. We don't go out on dates." "But you might if you meet someone." Her eyes are startlingly clear, the blue of swimming pools. "Lewis's mom goes out every Friday. He gets to eat Pop-Tarts." "If a date ever comes up, you can negotiate Pop-Tarts with Aunt Doreen." Stella grins. She loves me to use big words with her, and I haven't stumped her yet, though as she twirls away chanting, "Negotiate," I feel like I've swallowed a cannonball. I can already hear the scorn in Janice's voice when I explain to her that there will be no night out. GED sample question. If a savings account pays 5% simple interest, how much interest in dollars will $4,000 earn in 2 years? I have never seen $4,000 at one time in my life. I make up my own question. If a pack of cigarettes costs $5.30, how much is each cigarette in a pack? Stella storms back into the room, her new cowlick bobbing on top of her head like a decoration. She's holding a book she brought home from the daycare, and her finger is stabbing at a word. "What is this?" she demands. "Sound it out," I say automatically. She can get as far as B-A-L-L, but the rest stumps her, even though the drawing on the page is crowded with balloons, and for God's sake, it isn't that hard. "Below," she keeps saying. Tears are coming to her eyes. She hates being wrong. "Come on." I put her coat on, and we go outside, Stella not even asking where we're going. Janice is on shift, and she'll give us a balloon for nothing. Sure enough, her face breaks into a grin when she sees us. "What happened to that kid's hair?" 10 minutes when Mom wasn't looking, I say. "You want me to get some scissors to even it out?" "Nope," I say. "A balloon." "Balloon!" Stella whoops, finally getting it. Janice looks at her oddly, but inflates a green balloon for her at the helium tank and ties it off with a long ribbon. She's ready to tie the end to Stella's cowlick, but I'm not having it. My girl and I walk home, her pretty face flooded with the joy at the new word she owns, and all I can think of is pins, knives, scissors. I have a friend who is teaching a program for teenagers through a university in New York, and in a planning session, she and her co-planner person were trying to come up with ice-breaking exercises the kids could use with each other as they get to know each other, and somebody proposed, you may have heard of this already because apparently it's a thing, the compliments game, where you have to tell a compliment to everybody in the room, people you've never seen before in your life. My friend was horrified. I, on the other hand, was delighted. It's called exercise. I like your accent. You have nice eyes. You seem really smart. No, she doesn't. She seems dumb as a rock, and I'm just about ready to say so. We freshmen have had group building activities all morning with pizza vouchers going to the person who memorizes the most names or correctly links the right person with the right hometown. Now we're responsible for giving compliments to every single person in our first 15-person group. We're lined up as if ready to meet a firing squad. The girl next to me wears sparkly barrettes. We get little thoughts from our narrator as we go along. Turn-ons include kittens and hot cocoa in front of a blazing fire. The complimenting girl has almost made it down the line to me. She started strong, but she's losing steam. You have cool shoes. Then I like your backpack. And now, face-to-face, girl-to-girl, I bet you get a lot of good grades. The next complimenter has already started, overlapping the first one. The people running this thing, probably sociology students itching to put their new skills to work, didn't plan out their time very well, and we've only got 10 minutes for 225 compliments. You'd think upperclassmen would have done the arithmetic. But the compliments take longer now because we're not supposed to repeat, and the easy ones are disappearing fast. Your voice is nice. That's a cool bracelet. I saw you running this morning. You went really fast. The complimenter is supposed to hold the gaze of the complimentee. How can the sociology majors think that this will build group spirit? If I see any of these people 6 months from now, I'll remember the long gaze and the lies, and I'll hide. Your shirt's a nice color, the complimenter says to sparkly barrettes. Turn-ons include kittens and hot anal sex in front of a blazing fire. Your smile looks like you're keeping secrets, the complimenter tells me, and one of the sociology majors says, that's not a compliment. Yes, it is. The two who are finished take their place at the end of the line. They've done the hard part, but they still have to be complimented. They're whispering and looking over at the corner where the sociology majors made us put our phones in a box. The compliments, more and more stiff, tip over like dominoes, all coercion and no truth, like conversation over Christmas dinner. You have nice earrings. I like your shirt. You can go beyond appearances, one of the sociology majors calls out. I'll bet you're a nice person, the complimenter promptly says, and I have to give it to him for quickness. To sparkly barrettes, he says, I'll bet you're gentle around old people. Turn-ons include kittens and hot anal sex in front of a blazing house fire. To me, he says, I'll bet you're not gentle around old people. And the sociology majors make him do it again, even though I feel totally complimented. I'll bet you have good music. He gazes at me, just like he's supposed to. Shit, says one of the others, that's a good one. No, it isn't. All morning I've stayed well under the radar, not just out of the sociology majors, but of my new classmates. This is my skill. I disappear in plain sight. If a picture is taken of us, something that seems dismally likely, it will seem as if there are 14 people in the group, none of them me. Now I've got my co-freshmen assessing me, and I need to be careful. I do have a lot of good music. We're over our 10 minutes, and everybody's getting restless. The sociology majors have had to swap one of the guys away from the box with the phones. We're all hungry, and there's a smell of tomato sauce from the cafeteria next door. You have good color sense. Nice job with your hair. I can tell you like green. What qualifies as a compliment, anyway? A mere fact sheet can't. The longer this goes on, the more sharply I see every one of us. Sunburned knees and makeup lines and one guy with really nice hands. And for the love of Christ, it's sparkly barrettes turned to compliment. She giggles. Are you a design major? Because the way you put those bracelets together totally rocks. Are you an engineering major? Lucky you. You're actually going to be employed. This is like, guess your astrological sign, college edition. I can't blame her for finding an angle and working it. I'm just surprised she was able to do it. She's good at maintaining the eye contact, too. Are you a psych major, she says to me. I'm not any major yet. I haven't even taken a class. You look like you know things, she says, her eyes boring into mine. Turn-ons include kitten-eating snakes and house fires. I know I wish this exercise was over. Well, yeah. She moves to the dude next to me, leaving the rest of her comment unsaid. Do you think you're special? Kittens shot up by chainsaws. Anal rape. Conflagration. Now it's my turn, and there are no compliments left in the world. People's eyes are red from so much staring, and I've never felt so visible in my life. Everybody wants me to hurry up already. It smells like lasagna next door. But I can't think of a damn thing to say. The girl before me cracks a little smile. Hurry up, she says. You're very punctual, I say, kissing goodbye to any hope of ever making friends. Next. You don't feel the need to be too neat. You know what's in fashion. I'll bet you have a dog. Eventually, it's sparkly barrettes. I say, you would have found room on a lifeboat from the Titanic. I love that movie. She leans forward and squeezes my hand. Do you really think so? Totally. Her face is an astonishment. It might actually be emitting light. Best compliment ever. Gently, I try to get my hand back. That's great. Really. I didn't think you'd be good at this, but you're the best one here. See what a good compliment can do, says one of the sociology majors. Is anybody else hungry, says the dude next to me. I pry my hand back and finish up the line with rerun compliments. Everybody's sick of the exercise now, and we're all starving. But Sparkly Barrettes is bearing down on me before we leave the room. I missed your name at the beginning, she says. Eileen. She smiles. Hey, Eileen, when that ship starts to go, I'm taking you with me. Skip one. This last one I'm going to read is, it's different. It's in the second person, as you will hear, and it's in the form of a prayer. Sort of. Because you promised to be with me even to the end of time. Because you told me to be still and know who you are. Because it was said you would lead me through the shadow of the valley of death and take away my fear, but I still have my fear. Because you promised repose. Because I have not been made new. Because I still reach for the glass every morning. Because you promised me joy. Because you make promises you don't keep. Because when I ask where the rent money will come from, you say, how glorious is the daybreak. When I remind you that my savings have dwindled to pennies, you say, it is good that there is music. Because you expect me to be a mystic but did not make me a mystic. I have clung to your promises until my hands ache. When the day comes that I open them, I'm pretty sure I'll discover that they're empty. Because destruction might pave the way to salvation, but salvation can be destroyed again. You have lifted me up, as you promised, but salvation has set me swinging on a trapeze, looking for hands to clasp. Because those hands might come, and they might not. Because if I am left to fall, everyone will understand that being left breathless and broken on the 10th floor was good for me. Because everything you do or don't do is good for me. Because you promised to break and remake us when we go wrong, and because you have made us so that we don't want to be broken, and we often go wrong. Because last night I brought home a woman who smelled like olives, and whose touch on my wrist made my arm feel electrified. Because I wanted to shout in gratitude that there was such a woman, you made her, and I met her. Because she went home with me, and because we were shaking so hard when we touched each other that we both dropped our glasses, which held nothing but Sprite, a point you should appreciate. Because she is married, which I knew right away after she looked around the bar, then looked at me and said, neither of us should be here. I told her the truth. I come here every night. If I can't sit in a bar, then I can't go to parties, and then I won't be able to go to restaurants. I won't be able to let people come to my apartment. Before long, I'll be curled up all alone, and then the only solution will be to come here. So it's all about choice, she said. Most of it, I said. Then I'm choosing to sit with you, she said. Move over. Because you created choice. because life is an endless succession of choose, 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 and eventually we're going to choose wrong, and then you discover you waiting at the threshold of that wrong choice, even until the end of time, because your sheer patience might be the most threatening promise ever made. Because I've been alone so long, because I was supposed to be alone, and being alone was good for me, because I have been purified by solitude, because you also created a sense of humor, which has come in handy, because I laughed when we dropped our glasses, and so did she. I laughed again when I pulled her against me, and she did not laugh then. Because my thoughts run to her like water racing downhill. Because she is married. Because she sang along with the song on my radio and knew every word. Because she knows how to sing harmony. Because when she was little, she had a dog named Skipper. Because she is married. Because you are so elusive on some subjects and so icily clear on others. Because your forgiveness comes with writers, like contracts that used to come and I used to pretend to read, but rarely got past the third whereas. Because you will say you forgive any truly penitent heart, but that penance must nevertheless be enacted. Because I am not penitent. Because I want to call her. Now. And now. Because her husband's name is Gary, and I've never met a Gary I didn't like. Because she did not want to tell me about the accident, but I kept asking until she told me. Because people can fall from rooftops while doing nothing more exceptional than cleaning gutters. Because home maintenance can create a man who does not remember his wife's name, but remembers how to fumble for her waist when she passes with a pile of laundry. Because at first she leaned into his grasp, thinking that his body might remember her even if his mouth could not produce her name. She leaned into him until she couldn't lean anymore. She did not tell me this. She fell silent, her hard gaze directed at the table and her mouth soft. Because you gave her a soft mouth. Because comfort is sometimes offered and is a kindness. Because my heart swelled at her sorrow. Because you have given me a heart that would do that. Because I have entered a room with only one exit, a room you allowed me to find. Because I can see the future so clearly it might as well be my past. Because people who come together out of a famished need gnaw each other to pieces. It will be no time before I resent her for my helplessness before her need, as she will resent me. Because you have made the journey from joy to weariness a trapdoor drop. Because the early claims on us are the ones that endure. Because I am rushing toward my own sadness and hers, and I will not even slow my step. Because you will be with me in my suffering. Because suffering is what you made us for. My heart will break and I will turn to you, because you are the only one to turn to. Because you made the rules. Because in the heartbreak I already feel, you will be saving me. I do not want to be saved. Because my desires do not matter. Because when the time comes, I will be looking for you, the last one I want to see.
Wow.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm David Wochan from the English Department and our Creative Writing Program. This is the last reading of our Visiting Writers series for this academic year. I want to thank everyone who has been involved in participating in the readings, in funding the readings, particularly the English Department and the College of Humanities and Sciences, and our esteemable dean, Jim Coleman. So thank you to all for everything that you've all done over the course of this year. We'll have two readings, at least in the fall, the winner of the Larry Levis Reading Prize, and probably in September and October, and the winner of the Cal First Novelist Award, probably in November. So keep yourselves posted. We'll have a good series next year. And I have the distinct pleasure of introducing my colleague, Greg Donovan. I remember very distinctly my first conversation with him. It was on an evening in February of 2002. My wife was out for the evening, and I was alone for the very first time with our one-month-old twins. So the first time I heard Greg's voice, it was through a phone I was trying to balance on my shoulder while I was cradling a madly bawling newborn in each arm. Greg was calling to see if I was interested in applying for a teaching job at a place called Virginia Commonwealth University. And as soon as Greg heard the caterwauling, he offered to call back later. But I wanted to prove myself skilled at multitasking and confident in fatherhood, so I put him on the speakerphone while I changed the boys' diapers. And so I was too absorbed in the mysteries of correctly affixing Huggies to realize that his phone call might be life-changing for me. I did, however, suspect that I was sounding like a babbling fool in my conversation with Greg, and that bothered me, not only because VCU sounded terrific, but also because I immediately felt that Greg was the sort of person I'd like and admire as a colleague. And I'm immensely grateful to him for not giving up on me after that phone call and for his efforts at bringing me here. And he has indeed turned out to be the friend and colleague I suspected he would be. And everyone in the English department in our MFA program owes Greg a debt. He's worked ceaselessly for this place for going on 4 decades. As a gifted and devoted teacher, as a stellar administrator, and as editor of a certain online journal called Blackbird, which may well be the most distinguished such journal in the country. But tonight we're here to celebrate Greg's poetry on the occasion of the publication of his new collection, Torn from the Sky, which has just been issued by Redhead Press. It's a book of terrific imaginative and historical breadth. It takes us from Oregon Hill and Richmond on the one hand, and into the psyches of iconic figures such as Walter Benjamin, Vincent van Gogh, and the last Inca emperor, Atahualpa, on the other. But his attention also focuses, always with startling empathy, on characters who have been downtrodden and ignored by history. On a murdered Mexican immigrant named Laura Arroyo, for example, or on the sufferings of an unnamed black woman in apartheid South Africa. Again and again in the collection, Greg reminds us that ourselves are permeable, fragile, and that our lives are intricately and mysteriously intertwined. We very much need to be reminded of these things during a time when too much of our poetry succumbs to pomo, solipsism, or devolves to pointless trifles. And I should add that Greg's craftsmanship throughout the collection is about as accomplished and as exacting as you can get. Buy his book. It will show you what poetry is supposed to be like, but too rarely is. I'm proud to have Greg Donovan as my colleague and my friend. I'm proud to have the honor of introducing him to you tonight. Greg Donovan.
That's not fair. He's putting me in tears, you know. The first person that I will thank publicly, I have a number of people I need to thank because this book was a long time coming. First, I'll say thank you to all of you for being here. I'm sorry some of you don't even have seats. And it's wonderful to see so many faces of people that I know, that I love, that I admire, my students, my friends, my colleagues. Thank you for being here and helping me to celebrate this occasion. But first, I do want to thank David Wojahn. He not only did that marvelous introduction, but he also offered me crucial advice in the course of my creating this book. And there aren't a lot of people I would trust to give me such advice, and I knew that I could safely count on his help. And he helped me change the title and do all the things to the book. So thank you, David. I really appreciate that. I also should thank the college and Dean Jim Coleman for providing me, and the English department itself, and several chairmen who I've served under, worked under, who helped me have some time off from my work so that I could complete this book. And I very much appreciate that. Not only our current chair, Kathy Bassard, but I'll specifically mention Terry Ogle, who helped me lay the groundwork to get a little time off so I could complete the book. And I completed that book by heading off to Arizona and spending a semester living with my brand new wife at that time, who is the most important person who helped me make this book, Michelle Poulos, the talented poet and filmmaker who I'm the most fortunate person in the world to be married to, because not only do I get to talk to her all the time about poetry and ask for her advice, she's my first reader very often, my best reader, but also because she cracked a whip across my back and finished the book. A lot of my friends were afraid that, you know, they were going to have to pry my poems out of my cold, dead fingers. That's the only thing that was going to happen. So she even provided, Michelle provided me with a place to write in Arizona. I worked on this book sitting before a very old adobe wall, one of the oldest adobe walls in Phoenix, Arizona, in the Phoenix, Arizona area. And something came at me out of that wall, and I believe in that sort of thing. I believe that poets are conduits. I believe all of the writers are conduits for powers larger than ourselves. And so this book also owes something to all manner of voices from the past. And let me take you into the poems. So it's called Torn from the Sun, and that makes a little bit of a reference to maybe Icarus. The cover features artwork featuring Satan's derriere, which I'm sure is going to make this book popular with motorcycle gangs across the country. I'll be sitting around a campfire, you know, reading my book of poetry. So I look forward to that and visiting them wherever they are. Of course, the cover was done by William Blake, and that figure of the a very powerful demonic figure, the Great Red Dragon, stands in for the Minotaur. And this first poem I'll read to you has something to do with that, because part of the background to the book, my own personal autobiographical background, is I was adopted at birth. And I didn't find out that I was adopted until I was a teenager. As you might imagine, that was a shocking revelation. And that meant that for the first part of my life, I felt a bit like a minotaur, half animal, half human, with people around me not certain about how to deal with me. You know, a person from a dubious background. This poem is called Instructions for the Labyrinth. Abandoned in that maze, raised by those walls. Quarry must be, from the start, to hunt the raw block you seek, the translucent skin, the span without fault, the clear milk-white eye of myth. Stone that will hold and keep. Trace the fissure and pound it with iron wedges jammed between iron splints hammered with iron-headed mallets. Follow the spreading fissure as if you track the story of your birth. Open it for the levers, and with so many hands as can be found, push. You will not want the story. You will want sleep. Split it from the parent rock. Finally, the deep-throated crack, the massive release. Cut away the excess and flip it for leveling. A river rises now in the mountains of your birthplace from a dark cavern and a vast chain of underground streams and caves. You have been told. Save the polishing for later. There may be damage along the route. Ropes, pulleys, winches, levers, beams, and rollers. Muscle it. It must be raised from the hole. The uncle who tried to strangle you to silence was no uncle at all, not even friend, but stranger. Even now you talk too much, using words to grease the skids. Maneuver it from the sledge onto the heavy wagon with the tall wheels. Hitch up the mules. Again you travel to the reputed house of your birth. The rooms unfold into other rooms. No one knows you there. Hoist the load up the incline, sending down the mules, yoked to the empty wagon as the other wagon rises. Set the chocks again. You were sent away at birth to be raised by strangers, mother and father in the spill of time. that procession of hidden stars. Cast sand over the marble face and rub down with the smoothing plate. Grind for days. It will take two of you, more if they can be found. And when you find your way back again, your birth mother at last will deny you. The assembly must be seamless and follow the plan of the double axe, the seed pattern refined. Set your mystery in its navel. Then will come the sacrifices, the bull leaping, the bull fights, the dancing, the woven mosaics underfoot, the wine, the king on his throne, the quake and flood, the erosion, the mirrors and confusions of black moonlight, the statues that walk, the genius free or merely lost in the tumble, black water flowing out over the land, the broken gate swinging wide onto the sizzle of emptiness, where there is center everywhere and no circumference at all, the scream of its hinge to ride in your eye, torn from the stone, torn from the sun. I drink a little water. So the plan here, let's be 5 or 6 poems. We'll see how much time I have. The next poem is a poem that was at the center of my composing in what I felt like was a somewhat new way. It comes from my having experienced taking a hike on Mount Tamalpais, which is a mountain just outside of San Francisco. It's just west of San Francisco. Across the bay, it overlooks the Pacific Ocean. This is called Ravens at Tamalpais. Bald white trunk and dead black bark, tock, tock. Small shrubs in long black coats, their stripped pine whipping at the skyline. Swiftly unveiled in twos and threes, ravens and the ideas of ravens slip out onto air. Black silk scarves pulling each other through the silk blue sleeves in wintry sky and out into the mind's eye to stall and dip. Nip at tail feathers, roll and dive, flip, spin, fold up and fall, one thing after another in that sleight of hand to alight again, pinned to their pine, towering above the bay. The smashed hat of Alcatraz floating. Turn my cold face to your sun. Alarm calls, chase calls, flight calls, wing whistles, bill snaps, and among their clacking and clicks comes a ceaseless mimicry of our human speech. Talk, talk, they have captured on the wind, on the wing. And as the far white city sinks back into its fog, they speak for us in lost languages, confused tongues. The Alala of Hawaii, extinct in the wild, live only in cages now. The pied ravens of the Faroe Islands parade as museum stiffs. Yet here, these ancients, blown down and off course and away from ancestors in Ice Age Asia, swirling in a blizzard rage 2 million years gone, these strong, settled Tamalpais long before the word arrived. In Sweden, they were glass-bottomed boats, airy ghosts of the newly murdered dead, while in Denmark, they fed on the hearts of kings and still could read the thoughts of men before men themselves could think them. Within the eye of slaughter, the raven's eloquence, and who will love me when I'm gone? Ravens will call coyotes and wolves to the work to tear open the carcass for shaggy birds to feed upon. A raven forgets nothing and is a most skillful thief who brings away the shining and the bright, black-eyed poets stealing each other's buried cachet and flying farther and faster to hide what was stolen. A raven showed Adam how to scrape the dirt for Abel, and yet I have slept as ravens slid down steep banks of snow to take off again into the dizzying loops of their delight. I have slept as the sacred spies of Odin, his eyes and ears, his ill memory and blunt mind flitted down to swallow anything at all. Bird of prophecy, bringer of fire, protector of the tower, groom of the daughter of the fog, whose soft touch on ocean's hair will lure salmon to leap into the boat. Your mother swallowed the white stone, smooth as an egg. Tock, tock. Your cry is the knock at my coffin door. If I step up now to that highest trail's edge and slip off and flap my puny nightmare wings and cry out in the long fall, then you will hold me in the last dark of your glance. Fly to me, cure me, take out my eyes. Tock, tock. Here's a poem that involves a painter who you probably know if you know any painter at all. It's called Night Train for the Bardo of Auvers. Auvers, as you know, is located in southern France. Bardo is that state between lives that Buddhists believe in. Night Train for the Bardo of Auvers. Draw bridges over the Seine, steam up and down, levitating over long flyboats that ply the flashing waters which all day transport oil slicks of guilt and all night spin black whirlpools of doubt. The approach in a glass-ceiling boat is looking up toward yellow frames of passing window lights, and then I am there, aboard the rail coach, looking out. The milky whirl of night folds its arm over its face in the heart of the sky, its hurt palm curled in, crucified with the hard, sharp spike of a single white church spire. Boiling clouds mass along the horizon, climbing its stair of blue mountain. A bottle green cypress twists in its struggle against the pull of burning stars that wheel not far above in the cloudy sky, breathing smoke and black as coal, the heavy locomotive has broken from the dark to drag its cars along through roiling mist so thick and quick the train appears to rush backwards, and I am given to know my suitcase has been left on the platform back at the sad eternal station. And though I am now amazingly returned, for one like me, who has tried to slice off his own head, I have been electrified with color. And among so many rows upon rows of drab, lifeless bags, I can no longer say which one is my own. All right, here's a little bit of naughtiness. I promised my students, graduates and undergraduates, and the people who work for Blackbird, I promised I would read at least one naughty poem. And so here we go. But of course, because I thought the dean might be here, it ends up being a religious poem. Don't worry, it'll be naughty enough. It's called Taste. Maybe it's a failure of taste, maybe it's a discovery of taste, we'll see. Taste. When she put her finger inside his mouth, there was Hispania and the dusty roads pocked with droplets of rain before the wooden wheels came grinding the impassable suck of black mud. When she put her finger inside herself again, he was there too, taking the famous Spanish steps into the foothills among the azaleas. They were building the sunlit villa to which they would always return. When she put her finger inside his mouth, there was the temple and the hands clapping sharply against the steep stair, bringing back the call of the Quetzal, the star shining in her dark eye, the blood running down the stone. When she put her finger inside herself again, he was almost there, but she did not come that night nor the next, and another rung on the ladder that led to where had broken as the stars faded, the bright birds disappeared, the walls fell in, and she never came to him that way again. When she put her finger inside his wounds, he knew them all once more. She said she found it hard to believe all they had told her, yet he knew if she would believe, in that moment he would be healed for as long as the mockingbirds sang, as long as the taste nailed him down or gently wrapped him up and took him away to a story that wouldn't die in a world without end. Two more poems. This poem is one which David and Norman Duby and everybody else who read this manuscript said, I don't know how the hell you got away with that. And it's about a subject you might be familiar with if you've ever watched any late night TV. It's called Aliens Calling Us Away. All our stories are the same. We only want that glass of stale water to sit still by the bed, its idle bubbles hanging there, holding our tired faces, mirrored and upside down, like tiny bad ornaments. We don't want that small ripple to begin slowly whirling at its center, then the wobble and jump when the water starts to boil. None of us want that low hum, clouds streaming, lightning without thunder, that draw into wind and night. In the cone of pale blue light, many of us have been brought out alone to be lifted up into the silenced chambers of another kind of love. All our stories are the same. We have a calling. That one with the black liquid eyes looks once, and we cannot resist. We must follow the urge dreaming us, drawing us out again, to have our legs parted, our sex examined, our anus probed, the cold insertions in our mouth and ears. We are being used, our bodies taken for the half-alien children we will never understand, never be able to keep as our own, even if they hope to come back again to this watery planet that swims through the dark, the blue eye they cannot forget, to catch us up and make us slaves, to place us without a word in the zoo without walls or windows, the blank floor that might be nothing. And now, here it is, all over again. He is here, eyes black as spilled ink, spilled alien over the blank page to run wildly into itself, ink chasing its tail, ink squirming into such bent characters, black ink needing us, knowing what we are, yet calling us away. Isn't that what reading is? Finally, another person that I'm mindful of this evening, actually two people I'll mention, both of my brothers, both of them younger brothers, and both of them no longer here on this planet. My youngest brother died this past year. When I heard about the injury that turned my middle brother into a person who lived out the last part of his life as a paraplegic, I was at the U-Cross Foundation out in Wyoming. And so the story of his injury was horrific. He had fallen off a church roof on which he was working. His spine was broken in two places. Ultimately, he was paralyzed. He almost died. As I tried to find some way to accommodate what I was hearing and some way to pray for him, I went out and found my way to a medicine wheel, an ancient site, sacred site to Native Americans, that's on a mountaintop in Wyoming. And this poem arises out of that experience, and it ends the book, Torn from the Sun. Sleepwalker in the medicine wheel.
The spine snapped in two. Showers of sparks, burning snowflakes, then out. His rib punctured lung. Stop it. Start here. No clouds, sun pouring into my face, sloshing the pulse with its flood of color. The many miles gone, carrying the weight from this high place to home, where my brother lies broken, the rain-black roof, slippery Sunday shoes, the story of his fall scribbled out, signed in stars, wheeling unseen above these dropped stones. Tribal councils have decreed the long walk to this mesa. Old rock, earth root, snow dust, stone spine among the bighorns, rams off there on watch. Blackness in the mouth of their walking. I have stepped in the ancestors' steps, walked from my brother under the hand of the sun, to which I raise closed eyes to ask again. I have no prayer bundle, but this bag of bones, this schooled skull and its clapper tongue, now still and dumb, and still they come. Fire wheels whirling in the smoked sun, wheels of fire taking my brother where he must go. Wheels within wheels, spinning a cold flame, feather of soot each of us must hold, each dark that shatters in that red tide. Time returns paralyzed from before the light was born, the blood tide returns the sun. Tied to this chain-link fence, rattling around this mountain wind-blown wheel, prayer flags flap their wings for the far stunted pines. Little brother, nothing lifts. The connection gone dead. The pulse burned out. We will never survive that dark again, where you walked in your sleep and I followed, saying nothing. Where you spoke in your sleep and I answered. Buried in the heart of the wheel once was a buffalo skull, its sockets filled with long grasses. Now it's blind and deaf and gone. Circling left, always moving with the sun, I go walking on. Thank you.
There's books for sale.